I next met with Dr. Kathleen Moore, and to begin, I asked her about an issue that, with the historic first approval of a PARP inhibitor, specifically olaparib in ovarian cancer, has become a critical part of management of patients with ovarian cancer, BRCA testing.
So BRCA testing is actually a source of a lot of confusion, I think, in the community. So BRCA testing at its kind of most basic refers to testing for germline mutations, so mutations that a person is born with in one of the two BRCA genes. And those are huge genes. And there's a number of mutations that are considered deleterious. And that's what we've tested for many, many years. You know, BRCA has been known for over a decade. And patients have been tested for it historically when they presented with strong family histories, breast or ovary cancer at young ages, if they were Ashkenazi Jewish or other founder populations. That has very much shifted with now the NCCN recommending that really all patients with an epithelial ovarian cancer should undergo BRCA testing. And so what that means, what they're saying, is that they should get testing for the deleterious mutations that are associated with the BRCA gene. And then that even shifts for patients who, again, are of an Ashkenazi Jewish background. The recommendations really are to test them for the three founder mutations. For patients without that background, we do a broader test for deleterious mutations. But those sorts of decisions, especially when you have maybe patients of mixed ethnicities, really that's where the importance of strong genetic counseling comes in as well.
So why not just do the broader panel on everybody?
That's a great question. And I think that may be where we're moving to. It was an issue of cost initially. So for example, if your mom had a BRCA mutation, whether or not you're Ashkenazi Jewish, and you want to be tested, you just test for that mutation. And it's far less expensive, especially when you're testing unaffected individuals for whom insurance doesn't cover testing. So it's a much more cost-efficient way to test people. That kind of comes from when we did Sanger sequencing, where you're kind of sequencing one gene at a time. Now, I mean, I think you asked a good question, is now with next generation sequencing and the ability to do kind of massive parallel sequencing of not just the BRCA gene, but you know, any other gene you're interested in all at once at the same or probably increasingly less cost, these questions of should you test for specific one or two things or should you just test for everything is becoming a bigger issue. Some would say more is more. So it costs the same. You're not having to do reflex testing where you test for two things or three things and it's not there. So now you're going to reflex it to the bigger panel. Just do it all at once. It's more efficient. It's more cost efficient. So those things are all true. But the genetic counseling that goes into panel testing, where we're going to test you for the entire BRCA gene, which I don't think is that controversial, but when you add in all of the other genes that are in these panel tests, some of which, if patients were really counseled, they may opt to not be tested for, that gets a lot more complicated. And so I think the concept of genetic testing for the community where genetic counselors aren't widely available, there's a lack of them, and their services aren't well reimbursed, it makes it really difficult. So people are kind of sending these tests with kind of doing the best they can with the counseling, but the counseling quality is probably not where we need it to be to really be making sure our patients are well informed.
You were mentioning you received the first issue of this series, and on that, Brad Monk was commenting about this issue of genetic counseling, and he just flat out says, you know, I just don't send my patients. It ends up not being reimbursed. Is that in general the case? How do you feel about a gynecologic oncologist or medical oncologist ordering the test without a genetic counselor? And are there like online or virtual genetic counselors you could tap into?
I think that I agree with Dr. Monk's statements. I think that all patients with epithelial ovarian cancer should be offered testing. I think GYN oncologists are capable, and medical oncologists absolutely are capable of doing the pretest counseling, but there needs to be a concerted effort made at making sure that correct information is being communicated to the patient. It's not just another test. But the flip side is, I think it's always better to have a genetic counselor. So you know, you're talking to academicians who often practice in cancer centers where we have a lot of resources that the majority of oncologists in the United States don't have. So I have genetic counselors on hand. And when I send my patients, and I test my own patients because a lot of times in my world, in the phase one world, I'm testing them to see if I have a therapeutic option for them. It's very, very important. The family counseling is incredibly important. I'm not diminishing that, but in my world, it's, am I going to use this therapy or that therapy? And I need to know, you know, in a few weeks. So I can't really wait for the delay of a month or two to get them into genetic counseling. But I do have them follow up in genetic counseling to go over the results. And it's a little bit of a backwards way of doing it. But the counseling that they get about mutations in other genes that are involved in homologous recombination of DNA, that's the kind of inherent deficit we have with BRCA mutations, that patients who have a BRCA mutation can't repair their double-stranded DNA. But there's other genes that are very low frequency that also are involved in that. We don't understand their relevance for family pedigrees and treatment options. We're studying this. But when you do a panel test, which many of us are doing, and you find them, the genetic counselors are just essential in really giving accurate counseling to that patient. And I don't think that level of counseling is really realistically possible by people who aren't trained in genetic medicine. So I think it's always best to get genetic counseling, and we, for whatever reason, just haven't placed an appropriate value on that service. So that would be my first statement, but it shouldn't stand in the way of offering testing to patients, because it's so important from a family counseling standpoint to know if they're BRCA or not, because you can prevent cancers in their children and in their sisters and brothers. You can create previvors, which is always our goal, number one. And number two, we actually have therapeutic options now that depend on knowing that information. So we don't want patients not getting tested because they don't have access to a counselor.
Did you say previvor?
Previvors. We want to identify patients at high risk and prevent their cancers, and we can do that.
Previvor. I like
that. Previvor.
Okay. Somebody's a survivor because of prevention.
Right. Never gets it.
That's a good one. Broadly, putting aside the patients with ethnic backgrounds, what is the risk or what is the likelihood of having a BRCA mutation in a patient with ovarian cancer, and how does that vary with age or whatever variables make a difference?
So we're getting, as we're testing more universally now, we're getting a better estimate of that. It looks like the prevalence of BRCA1 and BRCA2 deleterious mutations is right about 18 to 20% in the United States. It's looking similar. There's some early data out of Korea where it looks similar. I think that's really surprising. So we'll kind of see as the other countries come in what the prevalence is. It is certainly heavily weighted in younger patients, but not exclusively. And Dr. Liz Swisher and Barbara Nordquist in Washington have done nice studies on this where they've demonstrated if you just screen your young patients or you just screen your patients who are high-grade serous histology, and I'll come back to that point, you miss a third of patients who have a BRCA mutation. And so limiting it to young patients and a certain histology loses a substantial minority of the patients from getting appropriate testing. So it does span kind of the whole age spectrum. From a histology standpoint, from a purist standpoint, you really only find BRCA mutations in patients who have high-grade serous ovarian cancer and maybe some high-grade endometrioid. But the reality is that most places don't have an expert GYN pathologist reviewing all of their cases. And so when you re-review cases that are called clear cell or even mucinous or low-grade endometrioid by an expert GYN pathologist, the pathology, the histotype can change, which is why if you talk to real purists, they'll say there's no reason to test people who aren't high-grade serous. And you'll see studies that exclude women who don't have high-grade serous histology. And that's probably accurate. But then you're really relying on your pathologists who have a hard job in front of them, you know, who maybe see a few ovary cancers a year. You're relying on them to make a triage as to whether or not you genetically counsel someone. Without expert pathology review, I think really the rule should be that all patients should be tested. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. What about specifically the type of testing? What types of testing are available and which ones do you recommend using?
So there's a number of tests available. Certainly there's a number of companies that just do the BRCA testing. So you're only doing BRCA testing. You're only testing for the deleterious mutations. And then when you're ordering the test, you can order BRCA 1, 2, or you can order the Ashkenazi panel. Those are kind of the two options in the United States. And a number of companies offer that. So you can just test for BRCA. And the FDA companion diagnostic for olaparib is the BRCA analysis CDX, which is only testing for BRCA 1, BRCA 2 deleterious mutations.
What's the technology or the type of assay that's done?
It's either a saliva test or a blood test, and it's next generation sequencing. There is an interest in what's called somatic BRCA, which is BRCA mutations in the tumor. Right now, the FDA indication is for germline BRCA mutations, and that's what you pick up in blood or saliva. So that's what you're born with. And those patients will have BRCA mutations in their tumor, but you can have patients who don't have a germline mutation in BRCA, but they have BRCA mutations in their tumor, or they have BRCA-ness, as we talk about, which is a whole bunch of things. BRCA-ness refers to a phenotype, like someone who doesn't have a BRCA mutation, but she's young and she has a family history that just screams BRCA, but you test her and she's negative. Why is that? There's something about her, some kind of, we assume, DNA repair, but she's a BRCA-ness phenotype clinically. And then you have lots of interest in identifying BRCA-ness in the tumor, in a somatic test. So the olaparib program is doing this. They're looking at tumor samples and they're using one company's somatic testing to try and look at patients who are more likely to respond to olaparib. So patients that have what's called loss of heterozygosity, and there's a couple of other tests in that somatic panel that proposes to identify patients in addition to those with a BRCA mutation who have loss of homologous recombination or other DNA repair deficits that would make them susceptible to PARP inhibition. Rucaparib is using a different somatic test on the tumor to identify patients who don't have a BRCA mutation who will benefit from that drug. Really, all of the PARP inhibitors are working on this so that you can ideally, you know, the number we don't know yet, people throw around up to 50% of high-grade serous ovarian cancer patients may benefit from PARP inhibitors. 18 to 20% of patients have a BRCA mutation. An additional 20 to 30% may have some other mutation or somatic phenotype that makes them susceptible. We haven't sorted that all out yet.
So you mentioned that there are a variety of BRCA tests or panels available, but there's one that's specifically a companion diagnostic for olaparib. First of all, what's the difference between that? Is it just that that's the one that was used in the trial, or is there some fundamental difference in terms of the way it's done?
No, it's the one that was done in the trial.
And so for a patient, for example, who's presented initially with ovarian cancer, they're being considered for debulking surgery, et cetera, what type of BRCA testing do you utilize?
We are doing, at our site, we're doing panel testing. So we do either the AMBRI test or the Myriad panel test. And really the decision there is not based on what test we like better. It just comes down to what the patient's particular insurance will cover because we don't want patients to get bills for this.
But again, this is not the companion diagnostic?
No.
Then you wait until they get into later line therapy and then repeat it with a companion diagnostic?
The panel test will tell us if they have, and you can do the companion test. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You can start with that. That's the most common mutation. So everything else is minuscule. I'm absolutely not making an argument that panels are better. That just tends to be what we use at our site. But a panel test will pick up on the BRCA. And if you identify a BRCA mutation on the Myriad MyRisk or the AMBRI test or the Quest test, you know, whichever test you're doing, as long as it's in a CLIA lab, that allows the patient to have access to olaparib once they're in fourth line and beyond.
So it's called a companion diagnostic, but it's not really required?
No.
That's interesting. And what's the difference between this companion diagnostic and these other tests? The other ones are broader, the panels?
The panels are broader. So the panels are going to test for the BRCA mutation, just like the companion diagnostic does, with the same accuracy. But it's also, and the panels all differ, the panels will test for anywhere from 6 to 50 additional genes that have some purported relationship to either hereditary risk or therapeutic options.
So the other agent I wanted to ask you about that I know you've been involved with, and you also have a patient here, a 65-year-old lady, received it, is the antibody drug conjugate mirvetuximab soravtansine IMGN853. Of course, we've seen really interesting things with lymphoma, brentuximab vedotin, HER2-positive breast cancer with T-DM1. So that whole concept of antibody drug conjugate is really fascinating. What is this agent? What do we know about it? And what happened with this lady?
So mirvetuximab soravtansine is very exciting. I have to admit some bias because I've been involved with this drug since the very first patient went on. Antibody drug conjugates, as you mentioned, we have an FDA-approved antibody drug conjugate in T-DM1, which is very interesting. These are not new. It's like one of those ideas of what's old is new again. We tried this over a decade ago and the linkers were not great and we just couldn't get the drug into the tumor. Now, I think just because of better engineering and also because of a lot of collaboration between drug companies and between smaller pharmas, there's lots of cross development of these agents that has really led to kind of an explosion in antibody drug conjugates, particularly in ovary cancer, which is exciting because ovary cancer, other than BRCA, which we spent a lot of time talking about, ovary cancer just for whatever reason doesn't have a lot of mutations that we can target. It's not breast. It's not lung. There's no BRAF. You know, there's not a 30% population that has a mutation that we can design a trial around. So it's been frustrating. But ovary cancer does seem to have these proteins or receptors on the surfaces of their cells that are tumor localizing. So these antibody drug conjugates basically take advantage of that. They, for folks who don't know, you know, I explain antibody drug conjugates to patients like they're arrows, or picture an arrow or picture a bomb. And the head of the arrow is programmed to something that is tumor specific. In the case of mirvetuximab, it's folate receptor alpha. T-DM1, it's HER2 amplification. There are other antibody drug conjugates in development that target a stem cell marker, mesothelin, MUC16, which is the protein associated with CA125. There's a number of these in development. So they target something that is on the surface of the cell so that the arrow gets to the tumor. And then the tail of the arrow has a variable number of highly, highly potent chemotherapy molecules on it. And those vary company to company. Right now, they're mostly microtubule toxins, but it's not paclitaxel. It's not vincristine. They're drugs that are way too potent to give free in the bloodstream. But if you have them conjugated to these antibody drug conjugates, when they're in the bloodstream, they're inactive. They get to the target, the whole arrow gets taken in, and then the microtubule toxins are, whichever ones are attached, are released. And so you get death of the cell that took in the conjugate, and then the molecules can diffuse to surrounding tumor cells and take those out as well. So that's the theory behind how they work. The mirvetuximab, as I said, targets folate receptor alpha, which is not the folate receptor that is normally involved in folate metabolism. So we don't really know what it's doing on the ovarian cancer cell. It doesn't appear to be prognostic for good or bad prognosis. It's just there. And it's overexpressed in about 80% of high-grade serous and some endometrioid as well, not clear cell and not mucinous. And then there's variations on how much overexpression there is. And we're still kind of looking at what that means. But really, from what we've done so far, the majority of patients screened for this program, and you have to send in either a biopsy or archival tumor to make sure you express folate receptor alpha, most people have screened positive. So the screen fail rate's been only about 20%. And, you know, as most phase ones, this was open for platinum resistant patients, mostly patients who were kind of what we call acquired platinum resistant, where they had seen 4 or 5 or 6 different things and eventually had run out of standard options and they get referred to phase one. So they had been responders in the past and were no longer responding, as opposed to patients who never responded, which I think is an important distinction. That's what you see in most phase one studies. But even so, in the phase one study, and this was presented at ASCO 2015, the response rate, confirmed responses, was 52%. And then we had patients who were enrolled when we were allowing just CA125 disease and not measurable, who had prolonged GCI, GCA125 responses as well. And these responses are not for two cycles. You know, they can be very prolonged responses. So we're very excited about this particular agent. I'm excited about a number of the antibody drug conjugates, but this one is one that I'm very excited about. I've had many, many patients on this. I think I gave you two examples, one of whom, this was her fourth line therapy, and she's on cycle 18 or 19 right now. Her CA125, she was a CA125 patient, was 800 when we started. It got as low as 15. It's 30 now, but her CT is perfect, so she's continuing. And then I had another patient who really had been through every standard of care option, plus a few trials, had lots of liver metastases, did not feel good, and was on her way to hospice when this, we were still in dose escalation at that point, became available, and she decided to try it and had a beautiful response. Just everything shrunk. She felt so much better. Was only on it for about 6 months when things recurred, but had gotten so much of her performance status back that she was able to go on two additional therapies and actually was alive over a year from the time we were talking about hospice, you know, because she just got such a benefit from being on this agent. So it seems to be a very active agent. It's just now moving into phase two testing that's just opened. So we'll see in a broader population what it looks like. And we're just starting to do studies of it in combination with chemo. So as a chemo replacement with carboplatin, with Doxil and bevacizumab. So it's moving forward in testing, but early studies look very promising.
It kind of reminds me, before TM1 is approved, a couple of years before that, I started hearing cases from investigators of people who were just sick, got TDM1, they responded, and, you know, kind of like what you just described. And, you know, it gets into the question of, you know, how much evidence do you need to want to bring an agent like that into practice? I was hearing about these cases of TDM1 saying, wow, you know, it seems like people would want to use it single agent, you know, as opposed to combining with chemo, a lot harder to tease out whether people are benefiting. I'm just kind of curious, right now, would you like to have that agent available in your practice?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, we were talking about sort of you're interviewing selected populations of people. So, you know, I have this open, and it's still open in phase one. There's some expansion cohorts opening, and then I have all the combination cohorts opening. And now that the word is out from ASCO, I'm getting lots of referrals specifically for this drug. It's moved into phase two, which is very exciting and what needs to happen, but that limits the number of priors, you know, so all of our patients who've seen 4 and 5 and 6 can't access that anymore. So I'm happy to still have options for them in the phase one setting where we can get them access to this drug. It doesn't work for everybody, but when it has worked, it's just been one of those things that makes it amazing to be a trialist, because you sort of, it's not curative, but it buys people back meaningful length and quality of life that they thought they weren't going to get. And that's really what we want for our patients, apart from a cure. It does have a unique toxicity profile that I think we are working hard on, and that is it has an eye toxicity. It causes a keratopathy, which basically we get these corneal microcysts that form in about 50% of patients starting at the starting dose level. So they come in usually like clockwork around cycle 2 and just say, I have blurry vision. And it's 100% reversible in all episodes thus far. We've not seen anyone that hasn't gotten better just by holding the drug. And then we dose modify it and really can keep patients on. And the company's working hard right now to figure out if there's interventions we can do that will prevent it so we don't have to dose modify. But as it moves into broader populations, I think that's going to be the thing that we really work hard to, because we don't want patients coming off of it. Vision, you know, our patients tolerate a lot, neuropathy, nausea, hair loss, rashes, you know, all these things that we give them, and they tolerate it with amazing grace. Vision is one of those things that is harder for patients to tolerate. And so I think if we have something that's causing blurry vision, really making sure that patients and practitioners understand that A, it's 100% reversible and we don't have to discontinue the drug prematurely will be a really big education push for us, because we don't want patients coming off of this prematurely who may benefit. But that's really, otherwise it's super well tolerated.
It's really fascinating. I mean, oncologists need to be neurologists. They need to be cardiologists, dermatologists for sure nowadays, and I guess ophthalmology too.
I've learned a lot about the eye from this program, yes.
Whenever I talk to a gynecologic oncologist, we always end up spending all our time talking about ovary because there's so many things going on. But I have to ask you about this patient with cervical cancer who's now on nivolumab. Of course, checkpoint inhibitor is the big topic in oncology nowadays. And kind of curious how she got to that point and what's going on with her.
So this patient, of course, is lovely and way too young. So she presented with something that shouldn't have happened. She had appropriately treated early stage, very early stage cervix cancer. And for some inexplicable reason, it recurred massively. And so then that's when she was referred to me. So she got standard of care, paclitaxel, cisplatin, and bevacizumab. Had a complete response really quickly, like really responded well, and then was on bevacizumab maintenance for about 6 months, and things started to creep back. And so I just added back in the cisplatin, and she was on that for another year with kind of eking disease. It was just kind of growing slowly, and she just wanted a break from chemotherapy, and she had had progression. And so we had a clinical trial open of nivolumab for metastatic squamous cell cancers that were genitourinary, so cervix, vulva, vaginal. So she rolled onto that and is doing great. It's too early to know. She's just at her first CT assessment, which is kind of the new baseline for immune checkpoint inhibitors, that first one, because things can puff up just from the immune response. So she feels great and looks great. It's too early to know whether or not it's working. But certainly for cervix cancer, you know, once you're past paclitaxel, cis, bevacizumab, which would be the standard of care, paclitaxel, carbo, for those who can't, for whatever reason, get that combination, there's nothing else that works. There's just nothing. There's all sorts of chemos that we try, none of which have any expected long-term benefits. So it's a very frustrating disease, not unlike endometrial cancer, where once you progress through our frontline, we just don't have active second and third line therapies. This isn't ovary cancer. So this is an area where, you know, we talked a lot about somatic testing of tumors in ovary, which hasn't been incredibly useful yet. In cervix cancer, there are maybe some bright spots in that we see PI3 kinase mutations of a certain type in about 30%, and those may be actionable. I think those studies are still pending, but we've certainly had a number of patients get PI3 kinase inhibitors, oral drugs, and do very well with cervix cancer. So I think that's a bright spot that we'll need to look into more. And then immune checkpoint inhibitors, as you said, recent approvals in lung and melanoma, patients are coming in and asking about these drugs. And fortunately, there are studies open in squamous cell cancers, and so we have them available for our cervix patients. Again, I have patients responding beautifully, and I have patients in whom, you know, it didn't hurt them, but it didn't work at all. And so patient selection is still a little bit of a mystery there, but I think there's reasons to be optimistic that there may be a role for this class of agents, maybe even earlier in treatment of cervix cancers. I don't think we really know how to use them yet, but there's definitely early signals that they are going to be useful in a proportion of our patients.
So just one more question about her. How old was she, incidentally?
She is 27 now, so
wow.
She would have been, I've had her for 2 years, so she was 23. She had a microinvasive cervix cancer, it was very appropriately treated by her physician, and for whatever reason, something weird happened. Weird things happen with cancer sometimes.
So I was curious what you've observed. This lady got cis, paclitaxel, and Bev. What you've seen by bringing Bev in with cervical cancer, and specifically any particular issues with complications?
So that's our standard of care. And in the state where I live, we have a lot of cervix cancer. So we use this a lot. I think that from my, you know, it has to be anecdotal experience, I seem to have a lot of patients who are able to come off the chemotherapy and we're holding them on bevacizumab for appreciable periods of time, which I think is a move in the right direction for patients who unfortunately have a terminal disease. So I think that it has been, in my opinion, a great improvement. Even with the chemotherapy, I think it improves responses. It doesn't really seem to add too much in the way of toxicity, unlike the ovary data where we saw, I guess we still see quite a bit of hypertension. It doesn't seem to be, these are younger patients, so it doesn't seem to be as much of an issue as it is in older patients who are getting bevacizumab. And we're very careful with patient selection. So it was called Gynecologic Oncology Group Study 240, which showed that this improved survival as compared to chemotherapy without bevacizumab. They did tease out the group who were at highest risk for the most catastrophic complication, which would be fistula. And that's really in patients who have had been radiated and their disease is in the radiated field. So I wouldn't say we never use it in that situation, but we look very carefully at the imaging and we counsel patients. And so I think we are cautious in patient selection to avoid that kind of a complication, because that's kind of a situation where you make things worse for someone who's already in dire straits.